Reducing Crime features conversations with influential thinkers in the police service and leading crime and policing researchers. Keith Humphreys, OBE, is a professor at Stanford University and one of the most influential figures in drug policy both in the US and the UK, having advised the governments of George Bush, Barack Obama, and Boris Johnson. We talk about why synthetic opioids are so much more dangerous, what academics get wrong about advising government, and why San Francisco isn't anything like Portugal. Hi there, I'm your host Jerry Ratcliffe, and this is Reducing Crime. Keith Humphreys, OBE, is the Esther Ting Memorial Professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. He's also a senior research career scientist at the Veterans Administration Health Services Research Center in Palo Alto and an honorary professor of psychiatry at King's College London. Keith has been extensively involved in the formation of public policy, having served on a White House commission during the Bush administration and a senior policy advisor in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under President Obama. He has testified on numerous occasions in the British Parliament and advises multiple government agencies across the pond. With co-authors, his book Drug Policy and the Public Good won the 2010 British Medical Association's Award for Public Health Book of the Year. His service to addiction-related services and scholarship was recognised by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth when she made him an honorary officer in the Order of the British Empire in 2022. When it comes to drug policy, Keith really is the guy. So it was great when we could get together for some pre-dinner drinks at the delightful MacArthur Park Restaurant and Bar in Palo Alto, California. That's between San Jose and San Francisco. As you'll hear, it's both a historic building and right across the road from the train station. And I mean right across the road.
The menu here is very good.
Yeah, this is very California cuisine. So this is a very historic building.
But it's also very California priced.
Yeah. This is the first Civic Community Center in the United States. That's this building.
Here?
Yes.
I'd have thought that would have been on the East Coast.
Yes, you'd think that. But those really would have been church-owned or something like that. This was owned by Palo Alto.
Right.
This building was designed by Julia Morgan, who was a very famous architect in around the first third of the 20th century. How it became a restaurant, I really don't know.
Yeah. It's funny that this counts as historic, and it is. It's fantastic. But I appreciate the history here, because I live a few blocks from Independence Hall and Liberty Bell.
I get a lot of good humor out of that, because I'll tell people, what's it like being in California? If something's been up since January, there's a blue plaque and a tour. If you want a photo, this is the cornerstone. It was laid 8 months ago.
It was funny to learn that you grew up in West Virginia.
Not what you expected.
No, not at all. You've come a long way from West Virginia, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I was just back there, and it's sort of painful to see. The overdose death rate there is almost 100 per 100,000, which reduces down to say, like, you know, right now, if you had 1,000 West Virginians in a room, in 12 months, one would be dead from an overdose, which is just astonishing.
Yeah.
I mean, the worst of HIV/AIDS was nowhere near that level of acute deaths. This is like, that's triple that. Kids I went to high school with are dead from overdoses. My high school, in fact, had about 1,000 kids in it. And I could see it when I was back in my hometown. There were always poor people growing up, but there weren't the lost ones that you see now in a lot of American cities.
Yes.
Who are drifting around downtown areas, shabbily dressed, not clear exactly where they are, some of them displaying signs of psychoses. Heartbreaking. You just wonder, like, you know, what the story was and that kind of thing. But you know, drugs is a huge piece of it.
I was recently doing field work with the transit police in the subway system in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And it's not just that, but now with xylazine.
Yes.
You know, we're dealing with people who have got open sores on their head and on their neck, which is the size of my fist, just weeping. Yes. Open sores.
Yes.
Because it doesn't heal.
Yes. I was sort of secondly connected to someone who they tried to keep in the emergency room, and several of his fingers fell off. And rather than wait for wound care, he left.
Holy shit.
To go get more drugs. It just really shows you the power of fentanyl.
I get all misty-eyed about the good old days of heroin.
Yeah,
don't you? You knew where you stood.
You knew where you stood with heroin. You could take a shot in the morning and go to work. And with fentanyl, 90 minutes after use, you're crashed and want to use again.
Yeah, people are doing two bundles a day in Kensington and Philadelphia, and a bundle is 15 vials.
Wow.
So they're injecting 30 times a day.
God.
And a bundle's costing like $65-75, so they're doing $150 a day. And I spoke to a guy in the street a short while back, and he said when it was heroin, he would take a hit in the morning, go to a job, take a hit at night.
Yes.
And that was his life, and he could sustain that.
So this helps explain why fentanyl exists. I get asked often, why would anyone sell a product that kills so many of its customers? Thing is, the most profitable product of the 20th century was tobacco cigarettes, which kills lots of people. But you got a lot of money out of them before they died.
Right.
So even though a fentanyl user's not going to live as long as a heroin user, you're selling 5 times a day or 10 times a day, and your production price is about 1% of heroin, because fentanyl is synthetic and heroin is made from plants, meaning somewhere there's a farm and there's a $7,000 supply line, and they have to avoid Coast Guard cutters and all that is obviated. So that's why it's actually more lucrative, even with the added death of your customers.
Many, many, many years ago, I spent some time in Burma on the borders there, and you can just walk through the poppy fields.
Yep.
And the farmers there are just scraping the opium straight off the poppy pods. But I was thinking when I was there, just the challenges of getting it from there to the marketplace.
Right.
And you skip all of that with synthetic drugs.
That's correct. And most opium farming and most drug farming is done in politically unstable areas. So you have to worry about war, rival warlords. You can pay somebody off. You can buy protection. That costs money. You need peasant labor. Sometimes the peasants revolt.
The peasants are revolting.
Yes, that's right. They get driven off by a rival. You have to pay off local officials because you can't really hide a farm.
Horribly unpredictable business model.
Absolutely. Blight, drought, all gone. Who would want to stay in that business? So it's no wonder it's driven heroin, not entirely, but almost completely out of California at this point.
How did you get into this?
With happenstance, I think, is with many people. I went to school at Michigan State University, which is in East Lansing. I was flipping burgers at a Wendy's. I was a psychology undergrad. I knew I was going to be a psychologist, psychiatrist, mental health. I really didn't know what.
How old were you then, though?
Like 19.
That's healthy. I mean, people who really know what they want to do age 19 for the rest of their life, those people scare me.
A little frightening. Yeah, I just knew something in mental health. And a friend of mine came in who was older than me, and I was struck by the contrast. She looked great. She was dressed in office clothes. I was wearing a ridiculous Wendy's uniform and covered in grease.
I think the ridiculous part there is redundant.
Yeah. And I was making the American minimum wage, was $3.35 an hour. And she said, I'm graduating and I have this job in the medical school working for a professor and I could recommend you. And I said, well, what does it pay? And she said, $4.40 an hour. She said, it's a project on addiction. And I said, oh, I've always been interested in that, which was a lie. And I've often wondered, if she had said it was about schizophrenia or depression, I would have done it. Maybe I would have been a schizophrenia researcher, which are perfectly fine things to do.
Just to digress for a moment, I'm listening to a book by the bass player from Dire Straits. And so much of life is happenstance. Just at the time when they had no money to put together a demo tape, and his aunt died and left him £500, and they had enough money to make a demo tape, and then they went on to become Dire Straits. Luck.
Yes.
Happenstance. Not lucky for his aunt, obviously, but your friend walking into Wendy's changed your life.
Yeah, at that moment, changed my life. And so that's how I got in. And it's a twofold thing about addiction. I would say it marries the heart and the head. So when I started to know people who were addicted, and I was interviewing people going into treatment, I found that very compelling. You know, you see love, hope, despair, struggles with control, death, family.
But it's all magnified?
Yes, it's all magnified. I mean, so the intensity of that was compelling, and I felt very badly for them. I know that people hate addicted people. I just never had that reaction of being mad. I felt sorry for them. Then the other thing was, the intellectual thing is very interesting, is that our species does this, that we will sacrifice food, money, home, family, the people we love, our values.
And a risk of likely early death.
Yeah, for non-nutritive molecules. An incredible riddle. Why do we do that? How did our species even survive with this incredible propensity?
Does this propensity, is there any evolutionary benefit to it?
This is an important thing. It's like, what's going on in addiction? Addiction is an adaptation of the evolved systems that we need to survive. Corruption of very adaptive brain circuitry that would normally help us do things like get warm when we're cold, eat when we're hungry, you know, meet a nice cave boy, a nice cave girl, settle down, have some kids, and then care for them.
Yeah.
That system being changed is what's going on in addiction. Why did Homo sapiens not get wiped out by this 10,000 years ago? And it's because the molecules just weren't there.
Right.
In 1900, there were only 7 documented cases of tobacco-induced lung cancer in medicine across the whole world. 7. Now, why is that? Tobacco's the raw plant. It's very hard to inhale the smoke. It's harsh. It's not that pleasurable. tobacco industry starts to form. They cure tobacco longer so that it becomes sweeter. They mix it with Turkish tobacco, which has sort of got a smoother taste, and they make the Camel cigarette, which is probably the most successful product of the 20th century. Now, all of a sudden, 7 people die of small cell carcinoma of the lung every minute, you know, from tobacco. So this could have growth of the commerce and chemistry with the invention of new molecules.
So we always had this potential, but we yes. simply didn't have the product that would activate that response.
That's right. That's right. There's really no comparison to, do you want to order now or do you want to order later? What would you?
A little later, I think.
Yeah.
If that's okay. Can you give us some time?
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
It's sort of like you can cut the pod of an opium poppy and get, you know, that raw sap. Comparing that to the fentanyl is like comparing a pea shooter to a nuclear bomb.
Right.
And it's modern chemistry that emerges in the late 19th century. So the synthesization of cocaine, benzodiazepines, methamphetamine, amphetamine, shortly thereafter, heroin. These were beyond nature. It was sort of more and more powerful, harder for us to deal with. And that's only progressed. So now you get a fentanyl, which is an adaption of Demerol, which is 50 times stronger per weight than heroin. And that's what's overwhelming us now. This is, we sort of, you know, something old, something new. What's old is the human brain, and what's new is this substance-saturated environment.
Does it continue to evolve? Have we reached peak potency?
No, I don't think so, because this is allied with profit in an increasingly globalized economy. So everybody has an incentive to make the next addictive drug, because there is no customer like an addicted customer. And in this country, you know, about 10% of the drinkers drink half the alcohol.
I think a lot of them have been my podcast guests.
Yeah. you know, the person who like, well, I have a bottle of wine on special occasions is not a profit center. That group, the 10% is, well, I have the equivalent of 2 or 3 bottles of wine every single day, day in, day out, is a very lucrative person to create. And as the world gets richer, contrary to stereotype that many people think, oh, poor countries must have the worst addiction. No, rich countries do. But as countries get richer, like China is, like Brazil is, like India is, they start smoking, drinking, and drugging more.
You've become a global expert. When you were doing the study, well, probably not when you were sitting in Wendy's, but within a year or two of Wendy's, did you ever think that you would end up on the White House Commission for Drug-Free Communities during the Bush administration and working for President Obama as a policy advisor? I mean, it's a hell of a meteoric career influence.
Yeah, absolutely not. Absolutely stunning. And I feel very, very lucky. Because there are many more talented people whose careers didn't pan out that way. And so much of our life is just a, you know, flap of the butterfly wings. And it's just really astonishing. I mean, 10 days ago, I was at the British Embassy in Washington and I got an OBE and sat down next to John Williams as they played Star Wars. And he got his honorary knighthood. And just felt, and
did he just lean over to you and go, and what did you do, bitch?
Yeah. No, if they just run over and said, there's a mistake, you don't even belong to be here, and like throw me out, I wouldn't even protest. I thought, you're probably right. If there's any justice,
wonderful.
If there's any justice in this world, I'm in a lot of trouble. So
what an experience. Well, thoroughly well-deserved. I think one of your secrets is that you're really very good at communicating this information, as we've already seen, which is something that I think academics really struggle with.
Terribly. Yeah, so I do speak English. That certainly helps. I think, so speaking in ways people can hear, listening. I actually listen when I work with policymakers more than I talk. And then I think it also helps that I've always been invested in human relationships, having worked with people in governments now for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, and a lot of them are my friends and I know their children and that kind of thing. And that builds trust. So they know that when I tell them things, I'm not telling to spin them. I'm telling them because I know they would like to succeed and I would like them to succeed.
What's it like working with administrations from opposite ends of the political spectrum?
Well, you have to be a compartmentalizer. So in 2008, there was a very big bill, mental health parity and addiction equity, which sort of was the first sort of transformation of American health insurance to cover mental illness and addiction.
So this has been around the start of the Obama administration.
Yeah, I think it was probably the last bill that George W. Bush signed, and then the regulations of it were written by the Obama administration right when I came in. And I was involved as an advocate at this point. And I had friends in advocacy, dear friends, who said, you know, if there's a senator or a congressperson who will not admit that mental illness is a disease, I don't want their vote. And my view was, I do want their vote. I don't care if they're voting because they think this looks good to my constituents. I don't care if they're voting because they think it will reduce crime in their district. The point is that life will be better for this group of people.
Right.
Now, that's a very compartmentalized kind of view. And I take that when I work with people who I may disagree with on 100 other issues. But to me, it's irrelevant. We're working on the one thing I actually understand, which is addiction and mental health policy. And as long as we can agree on that, it doesn't matter to me that we have different views on tax policy. And I think this is one limitation on the impact of academics on policy is roughly half of people are more conservative, half of people are more liberal. But if academia is 100% liberal, that means like half the time they have nothing to say.
Right.
And that's, I think, bad for the country.
And I think an unwillingness to bite the bullet and work with people who you may have ideological differences on a range of other areas for the common good.
That is right. And I think also a certain amount of normative pressure to not do that.
Yes, that whole, really? You're meeting with them?
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, I was an appointee of George W. Bush, quite conservative president, on a White House commission. And then I worked for Barack Obama, obviously well to the left of George W. Bush. And then I went and did advising for Boris Johnson and when he was mayor of London. Do you have no core, you know, to you, Humphreys? And it's like, I have a core about caring about addiction and mental health. And it happened in all three cases. They did too. So there were things that could be accomplished.
I feel there's been a move, certainly during my time in academia, and I started in policing before I became an academic. So my time in academia is a little less, but 20 something years. But it certainly feels like criminology as a field is moving much more towards advocacy and away from the science.
Yes.
Is that something you've perceived as well?
Yes.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, especially when Caltrain is trying to, you know, drown me out here.
Yeah.
Succeeding as well.
Yes. You know? What's happening in academia is less and less ideological variability among faculty. Some people say, what do you mean? You know, I'm a Trotskyite, she's more of a classical Marxist. You know?
Right.
I know there's that kind of thing. But like relative to national politics, you know, people who would all be clumped at one end.
Yeah.
And when that happens, it's not good for science because any science that happens to produce a result consistent with that ideology has a risk of being waved through, even though if it's methodologically poor and sort of accepted as this is the truth, and therefore we must go promulgate it. And something that's not consistent, that may be a very good piece of science, you know, may never even get published because people sort of say, you know, well, and they find all these flaws.
Bertrand Russell said, you know, if we agree with it, we love every part of it. And if we disagree with it, we seek out every single flaw
possible
in the paper.
Yes. So I see that phenomenon a lot, even with people who don't think of that as activism, but it is. And then there's also sort of a move of people to just describe themselves as, you know, I'm an activist. Science is just kind of a Foucauldian kind of understanding. Science is just one basis of power.
You know, everybody switched off as soon as you said Foucault, right?
Yeah, did I? Yeah, that's okay. I did read Foucault in grad school.
More than I did then.
Yeah, I read one book. It was actually very well written, but it was not well reasoned. That's sort of the problem. But now, of course, people just say it's science is just there to serve the cause. You know, I'm an editor of a journal and people write in and say, you know, this article showing this intervention didn't work harms vulnerable people. You should never have published it. You know, if a treatment doesn't work, then I think it would be the worst possible thing to do for vulnerable people to say, well, let's pretend it does work.
Yeah. It doesn't work because we wish it so.
Yes. And people putting in reviews, this is true, but it might be used by someone to do this, so it shouldn't be published. You're supposed to stop in science at this is true.
Yes.
That's what I'm here to do, truth.
Well, as Neil deGrasse Tyson, the physicist, quoted, you know, the nice thing about science is it's true whether or not you believe in it.
Yes, that's right. And I think there's a conceit in academia that academics always listen to the evidence and everyone else is biased. And I just have seen no evidence of that. I see no evidence that politicians are any less data-oriented than scientists are. And you know, you can give a talk at a conference and say, oh, those dumb politicians, it's about politics, politics, politics. Now, and all those people, yes, would nod sagely, yes, if only they could be like us. But then if you came out of a study saying, say, women faculty are paid less than male faculty for the same work, don't think that all those people would run back to their institutions and demand equal pay be implemented immediately. They would find a million reasons why that wasn't right.
Right.
And I think that sort of smug narrative, in addition to being wrong, is actually impairs the ability to deal with policymakers because you start looking at them as if they were inferior to you.
An academic purism starts to creep in.
Yeah.
That's not warranted.
Yes. No, absolutely not.
Now, you've been successful in getting far more traction than most academics. What's been the secret?
I would say a couple different things. One is speaking English.
As opposed to academics.
As opposed to academic, yeah. So short, clear sentences with not 9 million caveats, very little jargon. I mean, you and I are trained in this stuff, and yet when I look at some of the stuff that is written, I can't understand it. So what hope does a city council person have who hasn't got that training, right?
Yeah.
So I talk just like normal. I think that helps a lot. I think I listen a lot. That probably helps. The willingness to work with lots of different people, even if I disagree with them on other things, but we agree on this thing, and so we can work together. And then the last thing is just the willingness to be useful, which not everybody has. I'll tell you a little story about this, if I may. I mean, you and I both know Rory Stewart, but since your listeners may not all know, so he was a very successful writer and now is a very successful podcaster. But in between that, he was an MP.
For a brief period of time.
Yes, yes. And he held a couple jobs, including prisons minister. And I'd met with him a couple times. And one time we were talking about a kind of management strategy for people with alcohol problems in the criminal justice system. That was the main purpose of the meeting. And just like 10 minutes before the end, he said, you know, I know this is not why you're here, but we have this problem of violence in the prisons. They're overcrowded. And is there anything that we can do about disorder in prisons? And I said, yeah, I mean, you know, some basic behavioral strategies you can employ. And, you know, you set rules, consult with the prisoners. What are the most important ones? Have immediate consequences that aren't severe, but they're predictable.
Yeah.
And then I gave him a prison in Pennsylvania. I said, they're doing it there. You can talk to them. And he was just stunned. And he said, I've had an entire faculty of criminologists sitting in the chair you're sitting in telling me, nothing can be done. The whole system is oppressive. You're oppressive. Until we have a revolution, you're fooling yourself to think you can make prisons any better at all.
I mean, he was talking about British academics, so I'm not desperately surprised because it's very ideologically captured to
yes,
some degree.
Yeah, but I also think, like, why did they even bother to meet with him? Was it just they wanted to go back and high five with their friends? Oh, I told a Tory minister he was stupid.
Yeah.
He's not stupid. He's a very smart guy. I won't want to condescend to the technocracy of, can you make the system work better because there isn't a revolution coming? Step down from that. I would just rearrange all of society. That's how I get rid of crime.
The part that I worry about is like, well, okay, jolly good. Yeah. But can you tell me exactly what your new world order would look like before I burn down the current one? Because
yes.
I can't guarantee it's definitely going to be better.
Oh, no. No, I think the history of revolutions is not encouraging. Some, you know, and I'm of course, I'm in a country that is a product of one. But, you know, as many of them were far more brutal than what preceded them. And also, it isn't true that you need to always have a revolution to change things very meaningfully. Look at the incredible American crime drop.
Since the 1990s?
Yeah. We didn't have a revolution or the same system of government. We've had, actually, inequality went up,
yep.
You know, and yet the number of people getting shot went way, 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 way down.
Yeah.
So it isn't even true that that's necessary. This is roughly the society we have. We have problems. I'm willing to give information that can help solve these problems and not call for a revolution.
I'm sure you've run into resistance because you're one of the few people that I know who actually advocates for not just carrots, but also the occasional stick in terms of program and monitoring
yes.
programs and so forth. So where does that come from?
So you could say, if you wanted to shorthand a lot of drug policy debates, that it's cops versus docs. And I work with both groups.
Docs, as in doctors?
Doctors, yes, doctors, yeah. So when I'm working with the docs, I'm trying to persuade them of the value of some sticks. And when I work with the cops, I'm trying to persuade them from the value of some carrots.
Right, nicely put.
You know, human behavior is shaped by consequences. I mean, operant conditioning doesn't explain everything, but it explains an awful lot. And when you have drugs involved, that is a very powerful reinforcement for behavior. So that means it usually requires some imposed cost for the person to want to change it. Addiction isn't like depression or chronic pain. People with those conditions will crawl through broken glass to get treatment and get rid of them. Most people who are addicted are very ambivalent about giving up that substance because that reward is so intense. And so why do they show up in treatment? It's usually because someone's pushing them. The wife says, you stop this, or I'm taking the kids and leaving. The boss says, you show up high at work one more time, you're fired. The doctor says, you keep living this way, you're going to be dead in 6 months. Or a cop says, or a judge says, you can go to jail, or you can clean up your act. You decide.
And I can't imagine that's popular in some areas.
So it's not popular among health circles. In fact, some of the people got to point and say, like, any pressure on anyone to change substance use behavior in any way is not only ineffective, but morally wrong.
And I did want to ask you about this. And I'm interested because I've been doing a project with the transit police in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Trying to help the vulnerable population in the subway system transition to treatment or shelter or care in some fashion. And we've been looking at the difference between whether it's just a police officer going and approaching them or a police officer and a social worker. Because at some point in the future, we'll test the police officer versus the social worker on their own. But this was we had a limit to how this was set up. And it's just anecdotal in terms of observing this. I think the presence of a police officer sometimes brings some modicum of coercion. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily sure that's a bad thing.
Right. No, it definitely isn't inherently a bad thing. You've been on the beat. You know, there are times when it's the worst thing. Like, you know, you have an ambiguous situation where, say, someone's in a mental health crisis and they're basically just frightened.
And but then the uniform turns
up. A police shows
up,
someone carrying a gun, and they flip out worse. On the other hand, other times it's a calming thing for everybody because a sense of, like, this is not going to escalate into a violent confrontation because we have a police officer here. So you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here kind of thing. So
that's a more formal version of it. And drug treatment and court mandated is also another more form of coercion.
Yeah.
I mean, is that on part of a continuum with, I suppose, family interventions, a more informal coercion mechanism?
Yes, yes. I don't know many people just like, I just really would like to try to pressure an addicted person to treatment because I'm offended by their life. It's usually our marriage is falling apart. I can't pay the bills because it's all being spent on drugs. Or he or she is violent and I'm frightened. And so it's rational and also ethical for them to say, I need a change here.
Well, so speaking about that, what is the science around coercion? I mean, I suppose there's two questions, I suppose, efficacy and the ethics.
Yeah, and there's also the compared to what?
Right.
The normative finding for coerced treatment is outcomes are usually similar to the voluntary treatment. But a big reason for that is most of the voluntary people are being leaned on by someone else.
Right.
So in some ways, it's kind of a contrived question.
But surely you could argue that could a comparison group be people who aren't in treatment?
Exactly. People who are, say, living in a tent and using fentanyl and meth all day. And people say, oh, it'd be wrong to coerce them. Voluntary treatment is better. That's implying they will come in. But is that really likely?
I sometimes wonder, and I worry that I'm about to verge into territory I'm not familiar with. This all presupposes that we're taking the argument that everybody is acting at their sort of peak rationality.
Right, right. Coercion can also be effective in the absence of treatment. Clinical people tend to believe no one can change substance use behavior without treatment. And this is a great example of how academics can ignore evidence. We have very good data on huge samples of people who used to have a substance use problem and don't anymore. A very small minority actually ever went to see somebody like me for addiction treatment. People change for myriad reasons. Sometimes they change because their life changes, their job changes. They lose something they care about.
They get threatened with an ultimatum.
They get threatened with an ultimatum. They have a scare of some sort. And so sometimes when I talk about coercion, I think people make the mistake of thinking, oh, you just mean, you know, mandating people treatment, that's unethical. It's like, you know, I'm actually just means putting pressure on people. The example of that, you know, is a 24/7 sobriety in the States, which is, it's called an alcohol abstinence monitoring requirement. But it's such an incredible demonstration of power of swift, certain consequences. It starts in South Dakota with a guy named Larry Long, who's a county prosecutor. You know, there's small towns in South Dakota. He's seeing these people cycle through the court for alcohol-related offenses over and over. You know, your fifth drink driving, and you got into a punch-up, and you broke into a house. And he sees it's very ineffective, everything they're trying. But second, he grew up with a lot of these people.
Right.
And he feels bad for them. He cares about them. He says, you know, the problem isn't their driving or conduct generally, it's the alcohol.
Yeah.
So instead of focusing the power of the court on other things, let's focus on the alcohol. He said, and he started sentencing people to not be able to drink, monitored every single day. So people would come in every morning and blow a breathalyzer. If it was negative, immediate reward. Well done, Keith. You have a great day. If it were positive, immediate negative consequences. They were arrested on the spot. They were walked across the street and put in a jail cell, which they stayed into the following morning.
Wow, this is really getting into the era of swift and certain punishment.
Swift and certain punishment, right. So I first heard about this, I was working in the Obama administration, and we were looking for things that we call the Holy Trinity. We want something that makes the public safer, gets the person to cut back on their substances or stop entirely, but doesn't fill up jails. So I went to South Dakota, and I expected, you know, half these guys are going to be drunk, rampage around the countryside, and your cops won't have the energy to get them. The other half are going to show up surly and hungover. Completely wrong.
I mean, that was just generally my impression of South Dakota, regardless.
Yeah, not nice. Not nice.
Sorry, South Dakota. Yeah, I'm only joking.
But I watched like about 200 people just go right through, breathalyzed all the way through, and like in half an hour, just bang, 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 every single one of them, they were monitoring perfect.
I mean, I can imagine this is controversial in public health circles to be supportive of this.
Right now in public health, there's so much hostility to anything law enforcement does.
Tell me about it.
By definition, it has to be bad. And second, this seems to be implying that law enforcement can affect substance use. Say, well, it's a health matter, and therefore only doctors can change it. As if doctors are the only thing that change our health behavior.
Sorry, but looking at their track record in some other areas, it's not been super in the public health area. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's tremendous failure around a lot of interventions for substance use that are invented by health professionals.
Yep.
So what are the effects of this? You get about 9%, 10% decrease at the county level in drunk driving rearrests. At the county level.
That's great.
At the individual level, it's like 50, 60, 70%.
But it seems if you're identifying significant repeat offenders, you're targeting the power few who are driving so much of the problem.
That's right. Overwhelmingly males between the ages of 18 and 40. But the other bonus was domestic violence arrests dropped about 9%. The vector is the alcohol. When you take that out, you get these spillover effects.
Can't beat it. That's fantastic.
And that's better than treatment. How we use the leverage of court now is we say, we will mandate treatment and hope for behavior change. The best way to use the power of the court is to mandate behavior change and offer treatment.
Now, if I understand correctly, you helped expand this policy across to the UK, which is a place you're very fond of.
Yes, I'm a hardened Anglophile.
Shocking, shouldn't be allowed.
Yes, so this is one of the real gratifying policy experiences of my career. I have a year off from Stanford University to work for the president. About 10, 11 months into that, my boss has a treaty negotiation thing in Vienna, the big drug treaty. And I said, look, I'm almost done with this job as senior policy advisor. So I should sort of connect you to a lot of my British contacts. Why don't we stop in London on your way to Vienna? And we'll go to Parliament and I'll introduce you and you can meet the Home Secretary and these MPs. And he says, that's great. So we do that for a day. And he goes on to Vienna and I finally have my first day off in like 6 months working in the White House. So I'm sitting at my club just going through the newspapers and I open up one that says, I want to try this South Dakota sobriety scheme because I want a blood and vomit free high street, said Kit Malthouse, deputy mayor for policing.
Bizarre quote.
And I thought like, this is a line. I mean, I don't know who this guy is, but I love that quote. So I sent him a note and I said, look, I've just spent a year in the White House. We've supported these programs and I understand how they work. And if you want to work together on this, I'd be happy to work with you. And he sent me a note back and said, oh, come on over. He went to the Oxford Policing Forum. John Calkins gave a talk where he went through just a bunch of different things. And John is a great policy entrepreneur, as academics go. He just mentioned this idea in the talk, and it captured Kit's imagination.
But it's interesting how it's not any notion of he'd been exposed to the scientific literature in long-winded peer-reviewed journal articles.
No. But I bring that up to say, because I have colleagues and students who would like to influence policy but don't want to deal with this, you just need to get on that circuit and get your ideas and data on it, and someone else can carry that to the policy-making class if you don't want to do it.
Right. Fascinating. Yeah. Yep. So you've had a lot of experience on both sides of the pond in terms of dealing with the politics of both sides.
Yes.
Both as intractable as each other, but in different ways?
It's very interesting. So British politicians are exaggeratedly mean to each other in public and very nice in private, and American politicians are the other way around.
Right.
So you have quite a few cross-party friendships and also a stronger influence of science in British policy. So I had this nice experience, I think it was in the House of Lords, and some said, yeah, you got to get Lord so-and-so on the side. He's kind of skeptical. And he came in early. He said, well, this just seems crazy to me. I can't believe this could possibly work, this scheme of yours. And I said, well, here's an epidemiological data. Here's some neuroscience data. Here's a clinical trial data. I said, huh. Well, can't argue with science. Okay, I'll support it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I really felt like saying, can you hold me? Because I'm about to cry. I've been working with the U.S. Congress for the whole last year where there are people who are proud that they don't like science.
Yeah.
If you do that in British politics, yeah, there's a few people like that, but generally people of all parties think, that person's stupid.
Yeah. There is and I'm afraid I find it in some areas of policing, and sometimes you find it in some areas of police leadership. There's far more tolerance for anti-intellectualism, anti-science in the US than there is in Europe.
Absolutely so.
Does that partly explain the differences between the experiences of the Portuguese in their strategies and what's been happening on the west coast of the U.S.?
That's a great question. The Portuguese famously, around the year 2000, decided to decriminalize possession of all then illegal drugs to build up their health services and create something called dissuasion commissions, which would assess people who had been picked up by the police for using drugs, make an assessment of whether or not they thought they had a problem, and then try to encourage them to change, offer treatment, and also apply both social pressure, but they also had the power to fine and that kind of thing. And it was an expression of, you know, a lot of things about Portuguese culture, which, of course, you know, Portuguese, first off, it has a very strong Catholic overlay, and it's a communitarian culture. I've spent a fair amount of time there, you know, and it's a lot of people live out their lives in the same place, and their parents live there, and their grandparents live there. So unlike in San Francisco, where everyone's for someone else, you'd be afraid to use heroin on the street because your mom might find out.
Right.
You know, now what happened in the Western United States is harm reduction has become sort of fused with more right-wing style libertarianism. So people start talking about drugs the way conservatives talk about guns or about COVID vaccine refusal.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has the right to do what they want. Any pressure from the state is wrong. And also harm to others is irrelevant. If someone else is harmed, they should just suck it up. So that got pulled together and say, let's then do Portugal here, like in Oregon, where decriminalize everything. And Washington State, to some extent, has done that. British Columbia is doing that. San Francisco has, to some extent, done that. First off, they left out the dissuasion commission part. So part of the policy actually was putting pressure on people.
They deliberately had a component that was coercive.
The Portuguese did, yes, yes. Further, they don't have Portuguese culture. The West is the most individualistic libertarian part of the United States. That goes back to like at least the 1850s. They wanted freedom and individualism and self-exploration, all of which, by the way, are fantastic in many domains.
Right.
But it doesn't work well for drugs. And so this sort of idea of, you know, be who you are, explore, don't worry about other people and that sort of thing. That's not a good message to someone who's got a substance use problem.
Right. And I don't mean to laugh, but it seems painfully obvious.
Yes, it seems obvious, and it's certainly painful. It's not obvious to some people.
We've got people from California turning up in Kensington, Philadelphia. So they're immediately away from all of those informal coercive mechanisms that the Portuguese have, like family and friends and everybody that knows you, seeing you on the street going, hey, Bob, you look like shit.
Yes, yes, that's right. Before Portugal's reforms, they weren't using police very much, but they had all these cultural constraints. Out in the West, we had none of that, and the only one left was the law. And so you remove that.
The brakes were off.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why you see Oregon, I think, is number one in the country right now out of the 50 states for drug use, about 60% increase in overdoses.
So they've really blown it.
They have blown it. And I have to say, at least elements of bureaucracy, like Secretary of State, have admitted like they screwed up. There was supposed to be a rollout of a ton of services, which was completely botched. They had a ticketing scheme, which was just ludicrous, of writing people a ticket for $100, say, call this toll-free number and get a health assessment and waive the ticket. Well, 99% of the people ignored the ticket. The 1% who called, they weren't interested in treatment. So The Economist magazine figured out the cost of those calls worked out to $7,000 per call. And not a single person ended up in treatment that way. I'm living on the street. I've given up my family, my job, my self-respect. But this ticket for $100, that's it. No more fentanyl for me.
This is the wake-up call I needed.
Yeah, that's right. It's this piece of paper. Thank you, officer.
So for these cities, you know, we can't just flip it around, but how do we start to get back on the track where we get a much more balanced approach?
Everyone knows what they don't want. When I talk to lots of policymakers, and not just in these sort of particularly troubled spots, it's we don't want a racialized, carceral war on drugs, and we don't like the outcomes we're getting from what we're doing. But there's a couple things we do. One is dispense with the fantasy that we can run drug policy entirely on the basis of health. This is the flip side of the fantasy of the 80s and you know, 90s of men with guns and badges will solve this problem.
Right.
Like sullen adolescents, the health people, when we're in charge, things will be different. Now they're in charge and things are terrible. Just as terrible. The cops have been marginalized. Initially, that sort of emotional sugar rush of, ha ha, now we're running things and, you know, now we get the resources and you get the...
You get defunding.
Yeah, you get defunding, you get demeaned, and it's a mess. It is impossible to make progress on this problem only with a public health approach or only with a public safety approach. Police, you're there for the people who are dealing. Health, you're there for the users.
we're going to, you know, close down this open air market, and health people will be driving up in their methadone vans for any users who immediately want it. We're taking these dealers away. Those kinds of operations, you know, are critical. And also police, and have, you know, to their credit in a lot of places, become part of the health response. Proud to say it. I think the first time it was said in an American drug strategy was Obama's first strategy that naloxone needed to get out, police carrying it into the community, was written by me.
Well, then I can't tell you how many lives I've seen saved personally. Congratulations.
That's great to hear.
It's everywhere and I've seen it.
That's great to hear. And you know, I was recently doing some work in Scotland, same thing, they're carrying them. They said, we need to evaluate. I said, well, don't make it a long-term evaluation because you're going to see effects right away.
Well, I started carrying it when I was just doing field work, just walking around with the cops. Now I carry it. I've got it in my car.
Yeah, I do too. I have it in my car and I carry it with me every time I go up to San Francisco. You know, some health people, no, the police, the health is our thing. It's like, no, can't have this territorial, clannish kind of stuff. Everybody's on the same team. Doing harm reduction policing around open air markets with police and health side by side and with the community to close those down. And sometimes when I bring that up, someone well-meaningly says, oh, but there'd still be drugs and there'd still be drug dealing. And I say, you're right. All that would be different would be the neighborhood would be safe, children could walk to school, elderly people could go out in the street. That's all. That's all that you would get.
Yeah,
just that.
Yeah.
In other words,
we don't need that.
Yeah. What every middle class person thinks of as their birthright,
yes,
you would get back. You know, and David Kennedy said to me once, and I've quoted him over and over, there are lots of communities in America that have plenty of drug use and plenty of drug dealing and no open air drug markets. They're called suburbs. Turning a neighborhood like Kensington into something like that. Yeah, there's plenty of people using drugs, they're dealing drugs, but they're not on a street corner with a gun in their belt. There's not people passed out on the sidewalk. There's not people wandering intoxicated into traffic.
Many years ago in Philadelphia, we had an operation called Safe Streets, which put, and it was incredibly expensive, but it put cops on corners, on drug corners, across 300 drug corners. What I discovered was that the police had a database of anonymous tips about drug use. And one of the data fields in there was, is it outside or is it inside?
Yeah.
And when that operation started, there was this big shift from sort of 60, 70, 80% outdoors to 60, 70, 80% indoors.
Yes.
And I consider that to be a benefit.
Yes.
If you're complaining about drug dealing that's in somebody's house, it's because people aren't getting shot up in the street corner.
That's right. I was up in the Tenderloin and I was watching a woman walk her little girl to school, and she was walking in the middle of the street because the entire sidewalk was just covered with dealers and people in acute intoxication. In San Francisco and places like that, I have to say, you have to care about people who don't use drugs.
Yeah.
Like the harm to that mom and that little girl.
Probably 8 o'clock in the morning, I'm in a van driving down Kensington. And you see a lot of open drug use. So the cops really don't do anything. Really nice officer. She was great. But one thing caught her eye, and I couldn't really see. So she stopped the van and rolled back and rolled the window down. Really? And I looked to see what it was. And just as I could see, a woman walking her daughter down the sidewalk. But in between two parked cars, there was a guy with his shorts around his ankles injecting into his penis.
Yeah. Ugh.
And she shouldn't have to walk her daughter to school seeing that.
Right, right. Frequently, there's an effort to shut down this discussion. Any enforcement, that's just racism. You're picking on those people because they have dark skin. All the people being harmed in the neighborhood do too. Actually, I think it's racist to say low-income, African-American, Latino neighborhoods do not deserve the same protections that I deserve.
They don't deserve to have the same quality of life in terms of just going about their day-to-day business as everybody else takes for granted.
Everyone else does. Yeah. And it's like, that to me sounds like more an instantiation of racism than it would be, you know, an overturning of it. And that takes some courage to say it, because it's difficult to bring that when some of that accusation is thrown. Anybody who wants to make a neighborhood better is racist.
The neighborhood can be part of the victimization mechanism as well.
Yes. When harm reduction sort of evolved as a public health strategy, you know, initially mainly in Europe, it was always understood to be about the total population. And the change that has come in the United States, particularly on the West Coast, has lost concern with the total population, and it's only the people who use drugs. And they're, you know, that whatever harms they do to others are irrelevant. But that's not actually public health anymore. That's more of a libertarian understanding. Health needs to, I think, expel that toxin of actually sort of right-wing libertarianism and instead say,
Everyone matters.
I think we're in a position to wrap up because there's no way I'm editing this down because it's been just great fun. So I know you're a movie buff.
Yes. Big time.
You even post movie reviews, which I appreciate very much, and I follow along with those. Is there one movie that you think is the most realistic depiction of this whole area, the one that you would kind of give to students to watch because there are useful lessons in it?
Gosh, what a good question. What's a great movie about?
See, I'm leaning Trainspotting.
Trainspotting is a very vivid and powerful film. I guess there's movies about the business and movies about the experience of addiction.
Yep.
So I like Michael Vaughn's movie, Layer Cake, about the business.
Yes.
It's very stylishly made. It was sort of before Daniel Craig was James Bond.
Yep. And Sienna Miller was in it as well.
Correct. Yes. Correct. Yes. Didn't notice her. The reality of, first off, that many people in the business are not very bright. Very few masterminds. Some are quite sociopathic, but a lot are not.
Mm-hmm.
And also that there are people like Daniel Craig's character who believe you can somehow function in this business and not be touched by it. And a lot of what the experience of the film is that there is no way to sort of, you know, have a clean living dealing in drug trafficking. So I like that film a lot. For, you know, portrayals of addiction, so I like the television show Bergerac, which John Nettles made before he made Midsummer Murders, about a cop getting into recovery, trying to get into recovery. I like the old American TV show Hill Street Blues.
Fantastic.
Where Daniel Travanti, the captain, is an AA, and he also sort of slowly helped Keel Martin's character recognize his own alcohol problem.
Well, notwithstanding just the best theme tune ever written.
Oh, yeah, so many things about that show. It's a trend-setting show. It's a terrific, terrific show. Those I would watch. I'll put in a plug for those might be movie bluffs. My sons, during the pandemic, my teenage sons, I hired them because they're technically skilled. And I said, here's a pandemic project, because I had written about film for Washington Monthly Magazine and different websites. And if you gather up all my reviews and build a site for me, I'll pay you whatever I came or what I paid them. But anyway, the site exists. It's allgoodmovies.com. No bad films. It's awful to explain why a film is bad, so I only write about films that are good. So if you want a recommendation, you can get one there.
Fantastic. Well, look, Keith, thanks very much for spending some time with me. We've reached the coffee part of dinner, so I guess it's time to wrap up. I really appreciate your time, Jack.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks so much for asking me.
Thanks.
That was episode 70 of Reducing Crime, recorded in Palo Alto, California in October 2023. If you want more episodes like this, subscribe to Reducing Crime at Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple, or wherever you pod. Hey, it's free. Excel spreadsheets with multiple choice questions for every episode are available for instructors and are just a DM away. Check out reducingcrime.com for transcripts as well. Be safe, and best of luck.